My name is Dennis Pater, I'm 59, recently took voluntary redundancy stroke early retirement from the Bristol Evening Post. When I left school at 16, I took a 5-year apprenticeship as a compositor. That was in the days of hot metal, sadly, at a book printing firm in Bristol. And I emerged from that 5 years as a linotype operator. And the best jobs in linotype operating in those days was with the newspapers. And I was lucky enough to get a job at the Bristol Evening Post as a linotype operator.
Can you explain for people that maybe don't know what a linotype machine is and how it works?
Yes. Well, it's just like the name says, a line of type. Instead of, as you may have seen in Caxton days, somebody setting lines of type, individual letters at a time, this was a machine that would bring a line together quickly and go into a mould and cast a line of hot metal to whatever that line width was in the newspaper. And there'd be a bank of up to 30, 40 of these linotype machines in a newspaper office, and it would be very loud coming up to edition times.
Now, so you started, how did you make the transition into journalism from printing?
Right, well, it was the NGA, which National Graphical Association, was a very strong union. And in those days, particularly in Bristol, we had a strong NGA chapel, both on Days and the Western Daily, the Evening Post. The Western Daily Press had a separate chapel on nights. Now, during the 70s and 80s, there was very much the Margaret Thatcher was bringing in the trade union bill at a time when the industry was looking to change over to new technology. So things were changing, and it could be seen that the NGA powers were dwindling. Now, in Bristol, we were unable to reach a new technology agreement with the management, and so we carried on for several years using the hot metal system with new technology going rusty, sat in the corner of the room. The management was so reluctant to replace the linotype machines that they were getting old and worn out, and it required more man hours to produce a newspaper. So hence NGA guys were doing between 16 and 20 hours overtime a fortnight, some are doing that a week, and we're doing quite well out of it. When we eventually got round the table with the company and looked at a new technology agreement, there was an increase in pay, but guys said, well, hang on a minute, we might be working less hours, no overtime, but we're going to be worse off financially because of all the overtime we were getting. So that was the impasse that there was with the company. That guys were doing a lot of overtime. So it meant that the new technology agreement, whilst there was more pay on the table for working no overtime, the bottom line on pay people weren't happy with, because it meant that they were taking home less money. So we had this incredible new tech agreement, which included a guaranteed 4 hours overtime for everyone, regardless of whether they'd worked overtime before or not. So that was incredible. What was also good, because of the cutback in labour that we required under new technology, the company agreed that there would be no redundancies in the NGA, which was a unique agreement that we got in Bristol. Several people moved into the advertising department. Some went into the wire room and IT departments. Some went into the machine room. And the NUJ chapel agreed that some NGA guys could transfer if suitable. I was one of about 20 people that undertook a basic exam set by the company. And in the end, I was one of 9 taken on to retrain as a journalist. And in fair, the company made it the full training. We had to do everything that was required of anybody else coming in as a journalist. You know, 100 words a minute T-line, the local government law and English, or everything that was needed for a trainee, we had to do as well. And as I was going into it in my late 30s, I found getting up to 100 words a minute shorthand was the worst, and so did others. But anyway, came through that, and we all joined the NUJ as well, with the agreement of all parties, and that was a very good thing. And I think that came on the back of several NUJ disputes in years previously, where the NGA had given its back in here in Bristol as a chapel.
Can you talk about the relationship between the unions, particularly the NGA and NUJ in those days?
Yes. We had what we called a federated chapel here, where we would have a loose committee where we would meet once a fortnight, or as soon as there was anybody had a problem. It would include SOGA, Nat SOGA, that's the advertising people, van drivers, and the NGA and the NUJ. We would all sit down and discuss our problems, and if the NUJ had a dispute, then we would do what we could to back them, like work to rule, things like that, and they would do the same for us. And there was very much a coming together outside of work in the social club, and the football teams and cricket teams that were run by the company, which journalists and compositors were all in together. So we were all sort of close-knit, and we preferred to negotiate with the company rather than national officers in those days, and sometimes it got us into hot water. During one NUJ dispute, I can't remember the year now, sorry, but the NGA nationally told its members to go back to work, and we in Bristol didn't. We stayed out. We were the only NJ chapel in the country that didn't go back to work. And we stayed out several more days while our NUJ colleagues were out on the picket line. And it took our national officers coming down from London, several meetings held in the branch office before we agreed to go back to work, and put so much money each week into the NUJ's fighting funds. So on the back of that came things like the new technology agreement, where some of us were able to transfer easily into the NUJ and the NUJ chapel.
Now, there's been a gradual transfer of ownership of the Western Daily Press and Evening Post here from what I believe was a locally owned newspaper to compete with the Northcliffe Evening World, back to ownership by Northcliffe of the Evening Post, which was originally set up to compete with the with Northcliffe.
Right.
Can you just explain, you know, what the differences in ownership have meant for the unions?
Well, I suppose it's better the devil you know. And for years, when I joined the Evening Post, it was very much a family-run company. And when we had disputes and we met the chairman of the company and directors, we knew who they were on a personal basis, and they knew who we were, and we could sit down, and we had lots of differences as there was in those days, but even with all the stoppages we had, papers came out and the company still made its profits in those days. And then the difference was when it became part of the Northcliffe Empire, we weren't really negotiating at a local level.
Did that happen sort of at once, overnight, or was it something very, very slow? Because I think for people nowadays, you know, that the company was taken over. Was it sort of one day it was announced, or what?
Yeah, in a way, yes. The Northcliffe group had a very major shareholding in the Bristol United Press, as it was then when it was a local company. But the major shareholder was, in fact, Northcliffe Newspapers anyway. So it was always felt at one time that would happen. And as things happen in newspapers, it did happen overnight suddenly, and the takeover was complete. Now, the next thing that happened that affected unions drastically was the non-recognition by Northcliffe of all the unions. And by this time, the NGA was very much decimated in the fact that as people left, they weren't being replaced. There was that non-redundancy agreement, but as the rundown of the old technology happened, so people weren't being replaced, and the NGA sort of just faded from the scene, really.
So when are we talking about? What year, roughly?
We are talking roughly mid to late 80s, I would guess. So the NUJ no longer had a sort of powerful ally at its shoulder in the NGA with the rundown of the union, and then was faced with the non-recognition then, which Northcliffe imposed here for a number of years.
And what did that actually mean on the ground? What did it mean?
Well, it was very demoralising for a start for people, and it meant that people didn't renew their membership with the NUJ, or as they left and new people came in and they didn't join, because, quite frankly, we didn't have any power, really. We weren't recognised. Even for wage negotiations, we'd get an envelope every year saying what our pay would be for the next year. So there wasn't even on a one-to-one basis. We went in and we'd get given an envelope, and that was your money for the next year. So people could see that really there was the major problem was we had no muscle, for want of a better word, and really things, they were very sort of dormant years for all unions, I think, but particularly in the newspaper world, where the pendulum of power, if you like, swung the other way towards the management with the non-recognition of unions.
Now, the papers are now based at Temple Way. It's a big building, which was, I think, put there in the 70s. Were you around before that?
Yes, I was. I was around when we were in Broadmead, and the paper had been there in what wasn't a purpose-built building. It was an old warehouse with very low ceilings, and it was very hot and noisy conditions to work in. But in those days, there was a football paper on a Saturday that we always looked forward to producing. It was the Greenan. And, of course, in this city of Bristol, there's the rivalry between Rovers and City fans. And when the games were on in the afternoon, you'd get the goals come through very quickly because there wasn't the Sky TV then, or the radio coverage wasn't so good. And the place where you could get instant updates was being in the newspaper office, because people were working on the football paper. And the journalists, banks of typewriters, very noisy, and they would submit their copy for live stories about two or three paragraphs at a time on one sheet of paper, then it would go down to the composing room. They wouldn't write a story as they do today, completely, on a laptop or something. They would have to submit just a couple of paragraphs at a time, and it would be built up as the day went along.
Now we hear that with all this modern technology, sometimes even deadlines are even being pushed earlier in the day. What were the deadlines like in those days?
Well, ironically, in the days of hot metal, we had the one-star, two-star and three-star Bristol Evening Post. And the one-star paper came out about 10:30 in the morning. The two-star, roughly about midday, 12:30. And the final edition would be as late as 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And we would make changes as we went along. Very much labour intensified under hot metal. But ironically, these days, under new technology, when the company said, well, everything will be better, there'll be less people, paid more, and we'll be able to do more changes later in the day, it's gone the other way. And the first edition of the Evening Post is on the streets very early in the morning, in opposition to the Western Daily and the Metro, which, of course, all in the same group, which I find personally very strange. But I understand that the theory behind it is that the quicker papers are on the streets, the more they're likely to sell. But when you get the three-star paper out at midday or just after, people are saying, well, it's not an evening paper. Because in the old days, you'd get up-to-date cricket scores and race cards, horse race cards, and that doesn't happen anymore. So,
for a whole generation now, they have only known the Evening Post and Western Daily Press to be up at Temple Way. Whereabouts was it in Broadmead?
Opposite the Odeon, down the bottom of the hill there. And in fact, the building as such is still there, opposite the fire station, next to the Bridewell police station. The building is still there with shops on the ground floor level and offices above. So they've utilised the building well.
Now, most of us know what a modern newsroom looks like. Give us you've already told us a little bit, but give us a sort of sweep round the newsroom in those days, maybe talking about the 1960s, I guess.
Well, certainly from the journalist's point of view, they all seem to be huddled together in very small rooms with banks of paper on spikes everywhere and cluttered desks of newspapers and paper and typewriters clattering away, and all the guys seem to be smoking in those days, and ties undone round their waists. Some guys would wear the visor shades, like you see in some of these films. And but there was a great atmosphere. And in the composing room, again, it was very noisy with the hot metal. And on audition time, a journalist, a sub, would come down to the composing room to sub the page, a great big hot metal page, and he'd stand on what was called the stone, the other side of the stone from the compositor. And he would instruct the compositor what changes he'd made. He'd have his galley proofs, as they were called, that were pulled and inked up the type and pulled, so that the journalist had his galley proof to make his late corrections. Sometimes there wasn't time for all the corrections to go. They had to go without them. But in the old days, there was the barrier where the NGA wouldn't let anybody else touch the type. And that applied to the journalists as well. And one former editor of the Evening Post, who will remain nameless, showed me a permanent dent he had on the back of his hand, where one day he went to touch the type and he was warned not to. And a few minutes later, he did touch the type and he was hit on the back of the hand with a wooden mallet. So you know, the demarcation was very strict in those days.
As someone who's been working here as well recently, you talked about the atmosphere in the old paper. How has the atmosphere changed over the years?
Well, it's very much seems library-like to me now. It's very quiet, unless a really big news story breaks. And it's all very controlled, and there's not the shouting that used to go on. I think the atmosphere from that point of view is better. People are more controlled, and they don't shout and bore people off as they used to. And there's still the buzz around deadline, and people can get a little bit agitated on all sides, but it's still the setup of the news desk running the reporters, and alongside those are the subs. But because there's less changes of pages and less additions, the urgency of the running around is not there, and probably that's good. But generally, the facilities are better with the computerisation, and you've got your Google search and everything else, and computerised library, electronic library, whereas in days gone by, journalists used to have piles of cuttings going, looking through to see what they needed, whereas nowadays, everything's at the touch of the button.
What about the glamour of the job? Do you think that's it's true to say that it's still a glamorous job being a journalist?
Yes, I think it's still a glamorous job. I mean, from my own point of view, I went from working in a production environment, the same four walls, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, meeting the same people, getting in the morning, knowing what I was going to be doing all day. And where that changed was when I moved to being a journalist. Don't know what job you're going to be doing or who you were going to be meeting. And that still applies, and I still tell people there's that side of it. There's people that come in there, the youngsters, they think that after 5 minutes they're going to be on News at 10 or World Correspondent somewhere, and they soon see the realities of things like doing death knocks and that type of story that has to be done, and the grounding comes. I think that a lot of people, famous people on television now, had good groundings in provincial newspapers starting off, I think that's still a way for people to go, albeit the pay is very poor for people starting off, as we all know. But
what about a couple of memorable stories you've worked on?
Memorable stories I worked on,
not necessarily big ones, but you know, something that's you know, has really stuck in your mind.
Well, we did a story of a mum sat round a Christmas tree with all the presents of her kids for her kids, but they'd gone missing with her estranged boyfriend. He had disappeared, taken her children and his new girlfriend and their baby. So there was five of them. They disappeared. The woman found out that on Christmas Day, the guy phoned his family to say he didn't have any money, and he'd phoned from a post office in Morocco. So we looked at the story, and the woman decided her and her friend were off to Morocco to look for him. She had no leads or anything. So we discussed it. The editor said to me, "Do you speak any Moroccan or French, Dennis?" I said, "No." But everybody else around the news desk was saying, "Well, we ought to go, we ought to send somebody." And the editor just walked away and said, "Well, very well, then if you must go, go." So I and a photographer, we set off with these two women to Casablanca. We got to Casablanca, went to the embassy there, and saw the British ambassador, and he said he wasn't into helping checkbook journalism. And we said we weren't paying this couple, this lady and her friend. We were helping her, and we were going to do a story. But she wasn't getting any money from us, and we weren't paying for her to go. She'd paid for her own flight. So from the talk, it was discovered that this guy who'd phoned from a post office in the very south of Morocco. So the ambassador phoned the post office and said, "Yes, a man in dreadlocks, looking like Bob Marley, has been coming in here." And the woman said, that's my man." So we decided to head south for Casablanca, from Casablanca, and we ended up in Agadir, which is sort of a holiday resort these days. We went to the British consul there, who in fact was a hotel manager, and his hotel office was in fact the consul as well. We were doing all the talking, me and my colleague, and it was thought that the guy had gone to West Africa, which is over the coast, over the border from Agadir, not recognised by Britain at that time. So I phoned the office and said, "What do you want us to do?" And they said, "No way do you go across the border." They said, "Come back." The woman said, "I'm not leaving this country without my kids." I told the news desk that it could look as if we'd abandoned her in a hostile country if we'd left her alone. So we stayed, and we were talking to British people, the expats that were living there, and they said, "Oh, a lot of Brits live along the beach, travellers, British sort of travellers in caravans." So we went to the beach, and we interviewed people. We showed them a front page that we'd produced at the Evening Post saying that the people were missing. And we did that as a front page, and we persuaded the women to come back to England with us. That was after a week, no children. We had no children. About 10 days went by, and suddenly I had a call from the British Embassy in Casablanca saying, "Now, this is the ambassador here. We're holding the man that you want to speak to. We're putting him and his family up in a hotel. Will the Evening Post pay the hotel bill?" So I went to see the acting editor at the time. I was not very impressed with this, but we decided that we would have to go back. Mum was going back. We would go back for the reunion. It was going to be one of the kids' birthdays on the day that we got back. So we phoned the hotel, asked them to make a birthday cake so we could do a picture. But as things transpired, the day we were flying from Heathrow was the day of the really bad weather that famous weather forecaster had got wrong, said there was been no bad weather in Britain, sort of like a tornado-type weather. It happened. And so we were delayed from Heathrow. But when we got to Morocco and got to the hotel about 4 hours late, we said, "Where's the birthday cake for the picture?" They said, hotel said, "Oh, we've already given it to the family and they've eaten it." So that went down the ban. Anyway, the police were by now heavily involved in this thing, and the guy, who was very unhappy to see us turn up and blamed us, the next day he was taken before a court. He was going to be accused with sort of abducting the kids. And the judge asked the eldest of the three children, who was about eight, "Who do you want to go with, your mum or your dad?" Just as simple as that. And they said, "We want to go with our mum." And with that, the judge turned to the guy and said, "If you don't," and the children over, you'll be thrown into a Moroccan jail and appear before court on Monday. So we did. But it meant that we were then lumbered with three children we had on our hands. We had nowhere to keep them. We had no. So the expense bill started to mount up with nappies, and then we had to find an airline tickets for them to bring them back, which we eventually did. And I was pleased to get a letter of praise from the woman's solicitor in the way we handled it, because the editor had said we didn't have to take sides. We were there to do a story. So, you know, it took me a long time to come down off that high of doing that story.
What about censorship? Have you ever come across censorship?
No, I've never come across censorship. I particularly remember a woman who was pregnant, working for an estate agent in Bristol, and was taking the estate agents to court for unfair dismissal, claiming they dismissed her because she was pregnant. And these people were very big advertisers in the Evening Post, very big. And there was a lot of discussion that went on, but we still did the story, regardless of, you know, things working behind the scenes. This estate agents wanted us, you know, were saying, well, you know, we're a big customer of yours, but we still felt that we had to do the story. It wasn't, and we did. And whilst you get all these accusations, I never came across anything like that in my time in newspapers.
What about youngsters just coming out of college, just starting off in their careers? Have you got any words of wisdom for them?
Yes, I think what they need to do is listen very closely when they come into the newsroom. They need to study what's in the newspapers, the style of the paper, how it is written, and listen to instructions of how people want stories done. Because a lot of them might have their degrees in English Lit and English Language, but they don't really know the concept of writing a news story. And some of them don't pick it up quickly. Some of them are confident and writers, but haven't got the personality or the confidence to meet strange people and ask them very personal questions. And it all comes through work. They might find it tough at the start, but they've got to go through the grinding of these little stories, if you like, and show a lot of patience to work up to bigger and better things.
Journalists tend to be quite high-spirited and quite pushy. You have to be part of the job. Do you ever get any kind of bullying in the workplace from other journalists or from management or whatever?
It's a difficult one. Some people see things as being bullied, while others just thick-skinned and get on with the job as part of being in the newsroom. There was an unfortunate incident that happened to me when I was district news editor, and I was doing a 4 o'clock shift, and I was, when I arrived just before four, I was told that a member of management wanted to see me. He called me in and asked me to sit down and asked if I'd had a good day and had I had a game of golf, and I suddenly thought, he's taken a great interest in my personal life all of a sudden. And he was acting on behalf of a previous editor, not the current editor of the Evening Post, I have to say. And he said that the editor felt I would be better served in my position if I was no longer in the union. And I said that I'd always been in the union. I'd seen it as my insurance since I left school. And in fact, in my earlier days in the NUJ, the editor and everybody in the editorial team was in the union. Everybody at the top level of editorial. And I didn't see it that I should leave. And I didn't. And to me, from my years of skirmishes, if you like, with the NGA and the fact I'd been so long in newspapers, it was like water off a duck's back to me and no problem. But if it that interview had been with somebody a lot younger, they might have felt very intimidated by that.
So what's behind that, do you think?
Well, the Northcliffe policy, when there was very much, once the union was back and being recognised, they went through this, whilst they were being recognise this system of so many percent of the workforce had to be in the chapel to get union recognition. And there was a lot of infighting going on at the time, and I think the management felt that, you know, particularly people of a senior level, if all those weren't in the union, then it would help bring the percentage down. There was casual labour also working in the paper on a Saturday, particularly when we were doing the football paper. A lot of youngsters were brought in as casual labour, and the management at one desperate time tried to include those as non-union people when they weren't even full-time working. So there was a lot going on in that respect at that time.
What about union membership generally? What do you think it has to offer? And is it something that's still relevant? Because particularly a lot of young people now don't understand what unions are about.
Yes, I'm disappointed in the attitude of a lot of young people these days who don't feel that the union has a lot to offer. And I can go back to, and I talked just now about the Federated Chapel. One of the greatest things we achieved when we all stuck together, all the unions, was a very greatly improved pension scheme. And the thing we had to do to get that was we all walked crocodile fashion across the town one day, all the unions, from Old Market across to Transport House in Victoria Street, and we staged a protest meeting. And that led to greatly improved pensions. And what the younger ones don't realise is that over the years, a lot of the things that they now enjoy come about as a result of agreement with management and us having to give up one thing to get another. And it's disappointing to see that their attitude is, well, do I need the union? And I feel that their strength is weakened because they don't all stick together.
It does sound like in those days you were able to do stuff which was sort of proactive, actually getting increased rights for members of the union and for workers, rather than simply reacting to sort of bad things that the management were imposing and attempting to stop them.
Yes, I think, you know, the training was first class, certainly in the days of apprentices, and the banding scheme that we had in the union, NUJ that is, of pay, was very much recognised by everybody, and there was no problem when it came to wage discussions. And of course, in those days, the working conditions, if any desks or anything was moved or changed, it was always with consultation with the union. And that was one of the other things I noticed in latter years, when there was big changes in the room with new equipment, there wasn't the consultation with the union as there used to be. So all these things were done together. We used to be on a Christian name terms with the directors, and you could talk to them about things, and some things they chose to take on board and others they didn't, but at least we felt we were a voice being heard, which I felt in my last couple of years at the company that wasn't happening.